I'm Daniel Atlin. Welcome to Messy, where I have conversations with leaders about how they navigate and make sense of the mess they find themselves in. Today's guest on Messy is Tim McTernan. Tim has a really rich career and deep lived experience and is sort of a master of all things related to social purpose organizations. He's worked in senior leadership roles in provincial and territorial governments in Canada, a community college, universities, and he's advised the government of Ireland on setting up a new type of higher education. And I consider Tim as a mentor as well as a friend. Tim and I first encountered one another almost 20 years ago when we were both serving as associate vice presidents at the University of Toronto. I think in part we connected so well was because of our similar backgrounds and perhaps life philosophies and the fact that our immediate supervisors didn't really get along that well.
By the least.
Yeah, so we were actually forced to fill in the gaps. Mm-hmm. And since that time, our career paths diverged, but we've kept in contact. Welcome to Messy, Tim.
Thanks, Daniel. I'm back at you. We are friends, and you're a mentor to me in many, many respects. And I enjoy the time we spend together.
You and I have had the opportunity to connect a few times about the importance of sense-making for leaders. And of course, it's even more important these days in a world that sometimes seems to defy common sense. Tim, maybe I'll actually start by asking you to share your origin story. Maybe share how the early days in Ireland shaped you and your approach to life.
It is interesting. I grew up in unusual circumstances. I had a lapsed Catholic Irish father and an English Protestant mother. They met in London after the Second World War. My father had gone over during the war. I suspect, given his anecdotes, he had visions of joining the RAF. They wouldn't take him for health reasons. And he ended up working in the city of London during the war. My mother, from Battle, just outside of Hastings, the battle site of the Battle of Hastings, a very bright student in Bexhill Grammar School, got a partial or scholarship offer to the University of London when women weren't being readily accepted in universities in England. Didn't take it because she didn't want to be the poor person in class. She joined the British Armed Forces in 1942, was trained as an intercept operator, and posted to Bletchley Park Outpost Number 1, where she monitored German intelligence during the latter part of the Second World War.
How cool is that?
Well, she's on the honor roll at Bletchley. She always talked about it in very mundane terms about how you get off night shift and all you have for breakfast is a kipper. But she was mentioned in dispatches for picking up broken code at some point. That was quite helpful. And it's a nice little badge to have a mother who's associated with Bletchley. They met in London after the war, got married. She promised to bring up her kids as Catholic. They married in 1947, moved to Ireland, back to Ireland in 1950 to start a business. I was born, much to my mother's chagrin, a month late, on Patrick's Day in 1952. The local parish priest was quick into the nursing home and said, sure, look at Patrick. He's a lovely guy, lovely young little baby. And she said, well, if we're talking about names, George is one that I've been particularly interested in. Missus, take your time. But you'll have him down to the church to be baptized, right? And she said, well, if there's a rush on that, the Protestant churches, Church of Ireland is nearer to where I am now than the Catholic Church. Take your time, missus. That's my origin story. My mother kept her promise to bring her children, three in all, up as Catholics. She didn't quite know how to do it, but she took the responsibility seriously. I was shipped off to the Lake School for low babies and high babies. And I think it was in high babies, which would be senior kindergarten, where you realize that you are living in a different world than most of the other children. Because I think it might have been Mrs. Hughes who said, well, our mummies and daddies go to mass on Sunday. And I put up my hand and bravely said, Mrs. Hughes, my mummy and daddy don't. And she said, Yes, they do. Shut up, put your hand down. And at that point, I learned to be careful and to watch what others do before you jump out ahead of others. And I spent pretty much all of my secondary school at boarding school. I played rugby and I did public speaking. It was called debating, but it really was public speaking. I was the in debating circles, I was the rugby player who debated. In rugby circles, I was the rugby player. I was the debater who played rugby and the rugby player who debated. Well, whatever. I was always sort of on the other side in terms of context of people placing me in conversations. I had a good time at boarding school, and it broadened my view of the world from the fairly narrow confines of Kilkenny. But when you go away when you're 12, you sort of get disconnected from your family a bit. And one of the characteristics of being away is learning to sort of live on your own, you know, with friends and stuff, but you didn't have parents to talk to when you went home at night or whatever. So you became very self-contained in terms of how you manage things. But that early experience was one that carried through. Watch what other people are doing and learn from other people before you step out ahead of things. But I did a double major in psychology and philosophy at Trinity College in Dublin. I did a four-year program. And during the 4 years, I did summer work for a couple of years as a lifeguard in Ballybunion on the north coast of County Kerry, which is where I met my wife, whose mother owned the first hotel you got to when you came up off the main beach. And over the course of 2 summers, we sort of consolidated a relationship which we were able to maintain because she was at University College in Dublin. So early on in our lives, we got together. Early on in our lives, we sort of realized that we were going to stay together. We had got married early, had a baby not long after we got married. I was doing a four-year degree at Trinity. So we ended up with a baby and 2 degrees in 1973. I had spent the winter and spring, winter before and spring of 1973, working part-time as a research assistant for a prof who was on sabbatical from UBC, Bob Knox. An amazing teacher, but he sowed the seeds of perhaps doing graduate work in North America. And I applied to 3 of the University of California campuses and Canadian schools. I got accepted at UC San Diego. I got accepted at York. And I got enthusiastically and a much more grudging acceptance at UBC. We knew we had a place to stay when we got to Vancouver. And we had 7 suitcases, a 5-month-old baby, $1,000, and a sense that it would all work out okay. And it did.
Well, that's super. I think that's a great sort of intro into sort of how you came to Canada and how you developed. And I think what's behind, I think, a lot of your sentiment. And of course, as we've shared, we know we share similar backgrounds, you know, being a little bit of a foot in both camps in many different ways. For me, my father was Jewish. My mother was Anglican at a time when it was a challenge for sure.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, really understand that sort of feeling about where do you belong and do you belong in one camp or the other or oftentimes in neither campus. And that's, I think, influences, I think, a lot of how you develop too.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. So maybe actually that's a great sort of point about, you know, maybe I can ask you about what it's like in some ways being an outsider. Because you've been an outsider in many different ways, I think, throughout your career, coming in to do new institutions, new organizations, new cultures. And how do you navigate that as well? Maybe, you know, what it's like to actually, you know, jump in and try and sort of fumble around and make sense of actually those new cultures you're in.
I think that's a really good question, and some ways it's hard to answer, in other ways it's relatively easy. First of all, you have to get your bearing in whatever it is, and it's like standing off stage, watching the performers on stage perform, and trying to figure out the pattern and the rules and the roles that they go through. So we had to sort of learn on the edge about what the patterns were. A great learning experience for me a disappointment to Bob Knox, my supervisor. The summer of 1974, our first full summer at UBC, I got the opportunity to get a job on a project funded by the provincial government and administered through the psychology department. Bob had found some research money for me. It wasn't a lot, but this was a job that took me, gave me a slot on a team that was going all across the province looking at the health and community service needs of rural and remote and single towns in BC. It was Barrett's NDP government at the time, before the SOCREDs got back in. And I sweet-talked my way into dealing with coastal communities. And I was really fortunate to connect with the United Fishermen's and Allied Workers Union. And I was offered a berth on a small boat they had, where they had a union organizer and a cook on the boat, following the late spring herring season on the BC coast. And I can remember walking down the wharf in Port Edward, just north of Prince Rupert, with a briefcase. It's one that Miriam had given me for my 21st birthday. And I had jeans on and I had a shirt and a tie. And one of the guys on one of the boats I was talking to said, you're not kidding me with that briefcase and that tie. You know, you're just an ordinary guy like the rest of us. And that was powerful for me, because I was sort of trying to be an ordinary guy. And he saw my trappings being counter to what I really was. The other thing on that summer that we did, when I did a road trip along Highway 16, was not knowing the division of responsibilities, I went into a lot of First Nations communities and talked to First Nation people. And they were a bit bemused to see me. They were happy to talk. And I read the report. I did a separate report on First Nations communities for my part of the project when I came back. And written in 1974, the last sentence on the report was, in inverted commas, "The message I got was not about us, without us." And there's a court case on the provincial government C5 legislation right now, which essentially is based around the premise of not about us, without us. Graduate school was changed for me quite a bit when Miriam got an opportunity to interview for a job in Whitehorse as government records archivist. And I said, you know, touch the Yukon River for me when you get there. And she went up. Felt the interview went reasonably well, and shortly afterwards got offered the job. And so then it was, what do we do? Whitehorse for a couple of years seemed to make sense, but I had to come back for better part of three quarters of a year in 1980 to UBC, live in a basement apartment and finish up my data collection and data analysis work. So we had an interesting issue of managing a relationship at a distance when you don't have, you know, Zoom, you don't have phone calls are costly, you don't have mobile phones, and letter writing is the main means of communication. Got through that, and then the question was, what do I do for work in the Yukon? Because certainly working at a distance was not going to work. And I applied on a job in the Department of Health and Social Services as a policy director. And my very, you know, from our time together at U of T, how prissy one's credentials can be defined in terms of, and one's experience. And so I went into the interview and I said, I know I'm not the person you want, but I could do the, you know, if you can't find the person you want, I could do the job. I know I could learn it, which was not a successful way of engaging in an interview. So I got into the Yukon government sideways and got hired as a policy advisor doing socioeconomic doing the assessment of Foothills pipelines project plans for the Alaska Highway Gas Pipeline that was going to pull gas from Prudhoe Bay down to Alberta with a Dempster lateral pulling gas out of the Beaufort in a major project, which I was doing the assessment of the socioeconomic impact plans and transportation plans. That was my intro. Then the project fell apart about 3 months after we bought a house and locked into a 21.75% interest for 5 years. But Beaufort Oil and Gas development is ongoing at a big rate with Dome Gulf and Esso drilling offshore in the Beaufort. So I got turned on to that field as the Yukon government's coordinator for Beaufort Oil and Gas. And I did that for a number of years, which led me into having to work with the Northwest Territories government, having to work with representatives from Dome Gulf and Esso in Calgary and in the Beaufort. And it gave me and work across government. So I had to chair, as a policy analyst, a Beaufort research coordination group in the Yukon government that was full of managers and directors. And you don't do that by authority. You do that by essentially addressing their interests and their issues and their needs and trying to find ways of meeting them in a way that you actually could meet them and deliver on the topic.
Did you feel like an imposter sometimes? Like, you know, having to talk to all these different folks or did you manage to find common ground?
You know, when you're responsible for doing something you know nothing about, you do feel like an imposter. And you do feel like you have to live succeed by the good graces of other people. And in doing that, you can't make too many demands on them. The danger of that is that you do too much on your own and then you get called on. And so it's learning what that balance is between, you know, working with somebody collaboratively to try and put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, working with people to put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, but not designing the jigsaw puzzle all on your own. So I ended up responsible as part of all of that Beaufort stuff for coordinating all of the land claim responsibilities that the Yukon Territory had as a result of the Inuvialuit settlement agreement in 1984. And as I have mentioned to you on other occasions, my first foray into the first land claims implementation meeting in Inuvik was not a comfortable foray. I was seen to be the enemy in a very strong way. And that changed over time.
Do you want to maybe actually talk about that meeting, Tim? Because I think it's just fascinating how you actually ended up being successful from what you felt like, I think, going in feeling that you weren't going to be very successful.
Yeah, well, two things prior to the meeting. One of the people who'd been on the Yukon negotiating team for the Inuvialuit final agreement, a team that had been tossed off the table by a newly appointed federal negotiator because they were being totally uncooperative. One of the territorial negotiators who was very senior to me in the Yukon bureaucracy figured he was going to be the implementation coordinator. He knew everything about what was in the Inuvialuit final agreement, and he knew how to deal, you know, the Inuvialuit belligerently. And very deliberately, I think I was put in there, not because there was any sense that I could be productive, but I just wasn't him. And so I went into the meeting knowing it was going to be a challenging meeting. And my two principal sort of thoughts about going into the meeting was sit down, be quiet, listen, and be respectful when you or ask something or when you have to ask something. And so and be as relaxed as you can be, even though you're sweating buckets in the process. So went in. Meetings in the north, you know, were long days often, particularly on challenging and important stuff. And I sat there and I tried to figure out who was who around the room. And I sat and I watched. And there was one person who was part of the federal negotiation team who was carrying on into implementation from what was then the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development. And she was careful to keep eye contact with me over the course of the meeting. And if I was asked anything, she tracked, you know, carefully how I was managing. And if I was getting myself into any trouble, she had a way of entering into the discussion in what seemed appropriate ways, steering it away from any difficulties. And she was a colleague that I really liked working with over the subsequent years on a variety of other things.
So I guess, you know, that's amazing. Like, you know, talk about, you know, herding cats. You're actually dealing with so many different multipartite, you know, organizations and trying to negotiate things together, bringing them all together. I think, you know, probably actually a great sort of a background for you actually taking more senior positions in government and also, you know, leading institutions as well. And maybe talk a little bit about, you know, how you actually found ways to actually, you know, bring those learnings and actually start navigating a senior role in the Yukon and then your subsequent roles too.
I was asked to be assistant deputy minister in the executive council office responsible for the land claims secretariat, which was negotiating final agreements with an umbrella final agreement and then individual final agreements with the 14 Yukon First Nations. I ended up being a chief negotiator in land claims, coordinating across government for land claims and land claims implementation. And at one point, with a change in government, I was cabinet secretary, chief negotiator for land claims, and for land claims implementation. And if ever you had a role, it's as a chief negotiator and as cabinet secretary. Because when you're chief negotiator, even though you know you can't deliver and you have to say no, there is always a, I'm not sure that this is workable, but let me take it back. And it gives you breathing time. It gives you time to work, you know, think through other possibilities and other balancing countermeasures. But when you're taking it back to yourself, you can't do that. So you're at the table. And it didn't matter so much on the terms of the final agreements, the final treaty agreements, because the Yukon policy was set and it was very pro. The Yukon government was the first government in Canada to affirm the inherent right to Aboriginal self-government. It was the first government in Canada to negotiate separate self-government and stand beside self-government agreements with the treaty documents. So all of that was set in stone. The challenge was on implementation, and the federal government reneged on its implementation funding commitments. Never explicitly said, but we knew what was into the Treasury Board submission, and we were going to get a sizable amount of money to meet our obligations until the cutbacks when Martin was finance minister. So we got butkus for implementation. First Nations got butkus for, relatively speaking, for implementation. But the fact that neither of us had any money and the feds weren't going to give any more put us head to head. And so I got into a lot of trouble at the implementation negotiation tables because we couldn't deliver money. And the First Nations felt we were the only source of money. And I, you know, being cabinet secretary and chief negotiator, just were they weren't incompatible. It just meant your negotiation position at the table compromised fundamentally. And so there are times when you can end up in a role conflict, you know, by design or inadvertently, where you have to understand the circumstances and try and extricate yourself before you have somebody screaming across the table. Sorry.
Well, that sounds very much probably like you experience in other places as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that nuances and challenges with the role definitions and clarity that way.
There's another aspect about role that I've had the chance to experience in a number of different situations. From U of T, for the nanosecond I was interim VP research, back to when I first became cabinet secretary, it was in an NDP government and I was in an acting position. And so I chaired the deputy minister's group. I was essentially, you know, the orchestrator within government for the operations of government. And I had a deputy minister challenge me at deputy minister's committee once, like, who the hell are you? You're just acting. And it's a moment where you can either lose control or take control. And I was lucky enough to be able to respond in a way that affirmed my control of the room rather than lose control. If you're in a role, even if it's for a short period of time, or even if it's provisional, embrace the role and treat it as a real job for as long as you have it. It may not be long, but don't just preside. Treat it as you are. And I was, for the years I was cabinet secretary under the UKIP party government, I was always acting minister at the provincial ministers of indigenous relations table for about 3 years. And by the time the 3 years was over, I was the senior person at the table in terms of tenure, not in terms of role responsibility, but in terms of tenure, and embrace the role. You can't do temporary roles tentatively.
I love that. Embrace the role, you know, and assume the agency and make certain that you can actually, you know, get things done.
Yeah.
And in some ways it comes kind of down to, and you know, in my sense-making framework, I talk about improvisation and doing a little bit of innovating around the edges as well. And I think that ties into that as well.
Yep.
You know, become an expert in improvisation.
Yep.
And that sort of ties into, I think, you know, what you've had to do as well as you switch into different communities as well. And you and Miriam have had to do a lot of, I'd say, improvisation and perhaps reinvention as well of yourself.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we left the Yukon under the circumstances of a changing government. And it's interesting, we'd been through two and a half when the government's reelected, three. We're in our fourth changing government. And you notice that you're not being included in transition meetings. You notice that when you are having one-on-ones, there's a certain tension there that's not there. And so we both felt we were in trouble. And there were reasons where you might think externally we were in trouble. My role at the implementation table, where I had to say no all the time, there was one First Nation chief who couldn't stand to be in the same room as me at some point in time. And you know that whatever happens, you need another job. The job isn't sustainable. We would have had long odds on us being fired, and we would have made a lot of money if we had made bets, because we both ended up without a job. And so there are two aspects to that. One is you're leaving a place you really love and you call home. And the other is, what next? And Miriam had sort of figured, well, it's my chance to do an MBA. And I had seen a lot of college jobs come up in Western Canada and had applied on one or two and had gotten interviews on at least one in British Columbia. And the interview process taught me a lesson. I got offered a job at, as you know, at Canadore College in North Bay, which was suffering, as other colleges were, from the cutbacks during the Harris government era. And North Bay was challenging to come into, because it's like a lot of Ontario towns we've learned subsequently. You have people who've known each other since childhood. They've grown up together. They go to the same lake together. There's a sort of an enclosed community life and social life that doesn't leave much room for outsiders to come in and be part of that. So you can be respected, appreciated as a contributing member of the community economically or socially or educationally, but you're never quite of the community. And so we had to learn to deal with that in North Bay. It was complicated by the fact that about 18 months into my term at Canadore, Miriam got a job in Toronto, and she ended up ultimately as the Archivist of Ontario, a position she had for 10 years. So we had a commuting relationship on weekends, and we had an engagement issue to deal with in North Bay. But a lot of what we learned there made it easier to deal with being out in Durham region. I think one of the reasons I got my job at UOIT, now Ontario Tech. And I'm not joking here, is I wore cowboy boots to my interview. And I was outed by the chair of the board who came into the washroom in the hotel that the interview was, because I had, it was January, it was snowy on the ground. I drove out and I had to walk through the parking lot in snow, unclear parking lot in the hotel. And it had been suggested to me, why don't you wear your cowboy boots? Nobody will notice them. And you can tuck your pants in and then take them out. And I was in the process of taking my pants out from having tucked into my cowboy boots when I got outed by the chair of the board coming in. So when I went into the room, all anybody wanted to see was my cowboy boots. But that took the issue as I was coming, that I was coming from U of T away. You know, there is certainly a sense that U of T is, you know, snobby in there and doesn't have anything to do with the rest of us. And so, you know, he's coming out from U of T. What's he going to be like? Well, my cowboy boots, I think, helped immeasurably on that. And you go, you have all of these conceits. I can remember talking to the Durham College president, and he said, you won't believe the amount of community work you have to do out here. And I went, oh, yeah, well, no, I was in North Bay. I sort of have a feel for it. Well, I did have a feel for it, but North Bay was a community. And when I discovered about 2.5 months into North Bay that going over to Sudbury was not considered a good thing, even if you were dealing with another college or university there, that North Bay and Sudbury were two universes apart, and you deal with that. You get to Durham Region. It has 5 municipalities. It has a regional government, and each of the municipalities has a board of trade or a chamber of commerce. Each of the municipalities has its own set of Lions Club, Kiwanis, and so forth. And with a remit built right into your legislation to be regionally relevant and regionally involved, it was, for both of us, I think, quite exhausting, because you have every gala to go to, you know, multiplied by 5, multiplied by, and you have to get on with day work at the same time. But what it did do was you ended up knowing, you know, a lot of people in the region, and we still go out there to shop and to recreate and do stuff. It was a good place to be. The galas, as you know from your time in Guelph, they start and they go on and they go on and they go on. And then sometimes you have to get up the next day and be right on top of things at 8 o'clock. But you learn the community. You learn the ups and downs and in and outs of where things are working and where they are not working. And you get to know people so that if there's an issue, you can go sit down in somebody's office and deal with it. And you have a sense of what the solution is at the time, which is very different than if you're in a big research-oriented university like the University of Toronto.
Yeah, we talked as well, I think, about, you know, the importance of, you know, creating that narrative and that vision. So sort of getting people to buy in all along the way. And
yeah,
that can sometimes, you can have the best thing possible, but if you haven't brought people along, you know, with that narrative or that story, you're going to lose them at the end.
Yeah.
So, you know, even when we were at the University of Toronto, how you can have great ideas, but if you don't socialize them well, I guess, and adopt the right process, the outcome's not going to be, you know, successful.
Or you end up in a battle of wits. I mean, the Mars Innovation, you know, was one where you sort of start off trying to see how effectively you can put all of the tech transfer groups together from across all of the research institutions, most of them affiliated with the University of Toronto. And it becomes, in the end, a sort of an executive decision that's imposed on people who are resisting the idea rather than having it. And it ends up working out in the end, but it's not the best way to work things out.
No, and sometimes it won't work out if you don't let people address people's egos, address people's lack of agency, and perhaps having their voice reflected, actually, I guess, in whatever's developed too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you've probably seen that across your various roles too.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, and one thing, as you know, I shared with you this concept that I came across during my master's of change leadership, and that's the concept of a bricoleur, which, you know, it's a, It actually means handyman, I think, in French, but it actually has taken on another term, which is actually much more, I'd say, creative. And that's actually bringing together, you know, different pieces and different things in order to create something and invent something that's very different. And I think, in many ways, you really are a bricoleur. You've been able to construct something, every place you've been by bringing in and molding things and taking different strategies from what you've learned before. How does that resonate with you? Do you think that that's sort of a lot of what you've been doing?
Yes, I do. Because I learned early on that you learn by doing. I've always been when I went into the Yukon government, I was the sort of academic. They didn't know what academics were, so I was a stand-in for an academic, becoming a government employee. When I left government and went to Canador College, I was a bureaucrat going in to run a post-secondary institution. When I left Canador to go into the Ontario government, I was sort of like, well, you're one of those college guys out there and the subtext was you're only in here because there's a push to get more people from outside of government in senior positions in government. And I was a beneficiary of that. When I left the government I was a government guy in an academic environment and particularly in dealing with research. I was a known quantity in the research community because I was the ADM responsible for administering the Ontario government's research and commercialization program. So in that, I was a known quantity, but I was a bureaucrat rather than an academic. And going out to UOIT, it was... So he's been at a university, but he's really not a university guy. But he has worked in the only other campus in Ontario that has a university sitting side by side with a college. So maybe we'll take a chance. And the sad irony is, absent a policy context, there's so much more that could have been done across the two institutions that are on the Nipissing, Canador, and Durham College, Ontario Tech campuses. Although I think there has been some tremendous work done on teaching and teaching innovation and teaching evaluation. And so there are tremendous innovations that are happening, but it's despite the policy environment in which we operate, it's despite the funding environment in which we operate, and it's despite the general approach of government to its broader public service, which is to starve it rather than enable it, or starve the sectors rather than enable the sectors.
No, it's true. It's true. But also, I was talking to a vice chancellor actually in the UK a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying how it's so much easier to do collaborations and cooperations with institutions outside of the local area. That the greatest challenge is trying to do partnerships with people that see themselves as competitive or institutions that sort of want to eat your lunch a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
And despite the challenges of the UK, which are very similar to Canada in austerity and governments sort of pulling back, it's like the collaborations aren't working. So hopefully we'll see more of that in the future around, not just around the edges, but actually more central fundamental things for institutions too.
I totally agree. And here's the fundamental condition that I think needs to be in place to enable that. Government, politicians in government around the cabinet table, and then the officials supporting cabinet need to switch from being a command and control approach to facilitate and enable and to create the policy conditions. Funding is going to be tough in the future regardless, but the right policy frame can offset shortcomings in funding if you give people a vision and a license to collaborate, to be innovative, to try things that haven't been tried before, and to broaden the horizon on what's acceptable and what's usefully experimental work to push out rather than scrunch in.
You're absolutely right. And that's one thing that I know we've talked about beforehand is the incredible risk aversion of actually our institutions. And I think that goes probably from governments to colleges to universities and hospitals as well, is that institutions have been into a compliance framework that actually stifles risk, I think. And hopefully there'll be ways for us to get a little bit more of a balanced risk appetite so that actually we can see some innovation. Because without that, you know, the status quo prevails, right?
Yeah, we had a bit of a financial issue, unexpected, shortly after I got to Ontario Tech. And the view of at least one of the key ministers of the day was fire the board, fire the senior executive. And it took a deputy minister brave enough standing in the finance minister's office to say they found the problem. They came to us with the problem. They're prepared to work on the problem. Let's see if we can make it work. But the initial response was, you know, wouldn't have been helpful to the institution and would definitely not have been helpful to the students.
Well, and I think we've talked about that before as well, is the importance sometimes of being in the right place, in the right context with the right individual. Because depending on the individual, you can have a totally different sort of future and a path forward as well. So there's that serendipity or the opposite of it, which may be bad luck or bad timing. I think so many things that we have successful or failures all depend on you know, the right timing and the right people in the room.
That's absolutely the case. That is absolutely the case. I have been around wonderful people of great principle with whom I wouldn't share a political view on anything, but operate on the basis of principle. And you get through a problem and an issue much more easily that way than you do by looking around to point fingers and blame.
Absolutely. Shared principles, so important. And, you know, agreeing about approaches rather than perhaps about, you know, underlying sort of philosophies. Maybe right now there's a fair amount of dark clouds on the horizon, and as we indicated, government's not, you know, the most in the situation to be very supportive with financially to universities, and I'd say that there's a lot of other sort of things that are needy or getting the government's attention. What advice would you have for actually, you know, leaders looking into a complex institution like a university or a hospital or a broader government agency?
I think one thing that's realistically important to get a handle on as quickly as possible are the current operational constraints, how flexible they are and how inflexible they are. Find areas of flexibility and look at creative solutions around the areas of flexibility. I mean, we still live in a delivery system that's built on an agrarian society and an agrarian economy. We have learned during COVID to be a bit more creative with online and digital methods of program delivery, service delivery. We've learned to deal with virtually with each other, and we've learned to deal a bit more flexibly with schedules. And I think looking for flexible options that minimize the pain, even if they're disruptive relative to the current patterns of doing business or delivering services. We need to be able to do that and need to be able to get back to the point you were speaking about earlier, Daniel. Find the carriers of a vision and put them on pedestals where they can enable support and mentor people who can execute the visions. And that's not easy. And some of the transitions won't be easy. And some of the transitions will be hurtful to personnel and will be budgetarily challenging. But the status quo can't stand.
Absolutely true. You know, we are, it seems like, in the middle of a maybe an experiment or an inflection point where things are going to change. And we'll see what happens, whether there's consolidation happening within our public institutions or you know, new entrants, as you know, you're well aware, with private institutions and others. It's got to change because the the status quo just is unsustainable. So I was wondering, Tim, if you have a few more minutes, I wouldn't mind asking you a couple more stories. And one thing is, we talked about, you know, how improvisation and invention is pretty important. And you've got, I think, a really, you know, great story about improvisation and invention.
I was a lifeguard for 2 years. I was a lifeguard for 3 years, actually. One on the river in Kilkenny, the River Nore, before swimming pools were invented. You actually went swimming in the river. You didn't go wild swimming, which is the term that you use now, I think. I heard that in Britain a couple of years ago. And I was like, what the hell is wild swimming? Well, that's what we used to do when we went on holidays. The beach I was on in Ballybunion, long, wide, sandy beach with a promontory in the middle, a cliff on the north side, promontory in the middle, with the remnants of an old Norman castle on, and a sort of a rocky ledge that went out into the ocean on the south side. The beach split at high tide, and so you had to monitor both sides. And we didn't have any equipment or anything. There were four of us. So we'd have somebody on the promontory and a couple of people on the heaviest used beach and one person on the lesser used beach. And that varied from time to time, you know, depending upon the weather. All you can do is look at patterns when you're scanning with people in the waves bouncing up and down. And when the tide is out and there are tidal pools along the cliff and, you know, you're tracking to see whether people are, you know, sort of around the pools or whatever. And the second year I was a lifeguard, there were two near misses. And one was a guy bouncing up and down in the waves, bouncing up and down in the waves, along with other people. And I suddenly noticed that, wait a minute, where's the guy gone? And by the time I caught him, he was being swept out on a riptide. And we got him. Later that year, in September, I was doing a patrol along the beach, not many people there. And I noticed, wait a minute, there's a cluster of kids around one of the tidal pools. I got to go over there and look. And there was a young brother and sister, both younger than 10 years of age, in the pool underneath the water. And we're lucky enough to get them out. There was a brother and sister from a local family. It would have been a tragedy under any circumstances, but in Ballybunion terms, it was a tragedy. So look at distortions and patterns as something I learned from that. And then figure out why the distortions.
No, you're right. That's a great metaphor for what teams, what leaders in their teams are facing, you know, going forward in the uncertain waters that we're having, and with big climate events as well. So the water metaphor works too. So
yeah.
Thanks for sharing so much. Thanks, Tim. This has been great. You know, really appreciate, you know, hearing your views, your journey, your lived experience, and getting to know, I think, a little bit about your values as well, and how they've been informed by your background. And that's what sense making is about in a lot of ways, I guess. And hope you've enjoyed this as well. I hope it hasn't uncovered too much trauma that's been buried, and you're gonna be able to sleep well at night.
No, I've had my moments, but talking it through with you before we got on today was very, very helpful. So thank you, Daniel, and look forward to the next time we can sit down together.
Absolutely.